Welcome to This Week in the Warner Archive Collection, where we discuss our newest releases. I'm George Feltenstein, and I'm proud to be joined by my colleagues, Matt Patterson and D.W. Ferranti. We're having a birthday party. It's the 12th birthday of the Warner Archive Collection as we record this podcast on March 23rd, 2021. 12 years since Debbie Reynolds appeared on the Today Show with Kathy Lee and Hoda to announce the Warner Archive Collection was going into business. And that night I was on a home theater forum chat. The 150 DVDs we would be manufacturing on demand. 12 years later, almost 3,400 releases, including almost 400 Blu-rays, and a lot of great entertainment has come the way to the consumer that probably wouldn't have come if we hadn't gotten into this program, which was years in development. It's a perfect way to start talking about this really interesting podcast because this is our first all Blu-ray podcast. So what a way to show how far we've come. And not just all Blu-ray, but all remastered and restored. Even more exciting. Well, it's an impressive group of titles that actually spans from the 1930s to the 1990s. So we have an all Blu-ray podcast for the April 2021 releases for the Warner Archive Collection. All Blu-rays and being recorded on the very 12th birthday of the Warner Archive Collection's inception. So how appropriate is that? We span from the 1930s to the 1990s with a really impressive selection of feature films and an animated television series. So let's get going with the rundown. First, an amazing restoration that was a collaboration, which we'll talk about, of Dr. X from 1932. And this is a disc that has both the original two-color Technicolor version as well as the simultaneously produced black and white version. And there's a big backstory behind that, which we'll talk about. And we've had such success with The Thin Man and After The Thin Man that we thought we would bring you another Thin Man, literally, because that's the name of the third film in the series, Another Thin Man. And William Powell and Myrna Loy are back as Nick and Nora Charles in a gorgeous high-definition remaster, 4K scan of our best preservation elements. Very exciting. And from the same magnificent year and Warner Brothers, we have James Cagney and George Raff co-starring in Each Dawn, I Die, which is a classic Warner gangster movie and highly acclaimed. And it even comes with a Warner Night at the Movies package of extras. Very exciting. Then we move to 1940 and we go to MGM, where Fred Astaire and Eleanor Powell star in Broadway Melody of 1940 with a score by Cole Porter and the amazing Begin the Beguine finale. And then we go to 1947, the Oscar-winning Green Dolphin Street, starring Lana Turner and Donna Reed, and based on the best-selling novel by Elizabeth Googe. And then a Broadway hit from the 40s that starred Ethel Merman became a 1950 MGM Technicolor musical smash as Betty Hutton was borrowed from Paramount Pictures to star in Annie Get Your Gun with music and lyrics by Irving Berlin. And that's finally in high definition coming to Blu-ray. And then we skip 40 years into the future for Quick Change with Bill Murray, Gina Davis, and Randy Quaid. Last but not least, we have an animated television series that's a follow-up to an animated television series we put out on Blu-ray a few months ago. It's Josie and the Pussycats. They're back, but they're back in outer space. I would say we're going to have a lot to talk about just talking about the first movie, Dr. X from 1932, made here at Warner Brothers, directed by Michael Curtiz, and assembling an amazing group of talents, including Lionel Atwill, Faye Ray, one of the Warner Archive favorites, Mr. Lee Tracy, and a really phenomenal production design. And this disc has both both versions of the film because it was simultaneously filmed in black and white. Jack Warner did not want to have to pay for a huge amount of two-color Technicolor prints, so he had it shot in black and white at the same time so that they could have, for international release and small markets, black and white prints, which cost less. The Technicolor company found out about this and was not too happy. So the follow-up film the following year, Mystery of the Wax Museum, which we released to great acclaim last year, was not filmed twice. It was only filmed once in two-color Technicolor. But we have gotten both of these together, and our friends at UCLA Film and Television Archive collaborated with the Film Foundation and funding from the Hobson Lucas Family Foundation, as well as Warner Brothers Entertainment, to collaborate on this restoration, which was overseen by Scott McQueen, as he did with Mystery of the Wax Museum, to restore the one surviving two-color Technicolor print of Dr. X, which belonged to Jack Warner, and turn it from the, I'll just say it, god-awful, splicey, scratchy, horrifying mess that it was in when it was found and rediscovered in the mid-80s, and there's a story behind that, and the folks at UCLA did an amazing job in restoring this film so that it looks practically pristine. But we wanted to present the black and white version as well, which, since the color version was rediscovered in the 80s, the black and white version hasn't been seen since. So we went back to the original camera negative of the black and white version of Dr. X and did a restoration of that at Warner Brothers Motion Picture Imaging as well. And both of these are on the disc along with a restoration featurette, a featurette about Michael Curtiz and creating horror at Warner Brothers, which is very, very interesting. And there's a commentary from Scott McQueen and a commentary from Alan Rohde, both of whom contributed commentaries to Mystery of the Wax Museum last year. So we kind of went backwards. Last year, we did the 1933 Mystery of the Wax Museum, and it was such a success. Everybody got together again and collaborated on this restoration of Dr. X. We're very, very excited to be bringing that your way. So, gentlemen, what did you think of this disc?
It's interesting. I mean, not so much the disc right now, because the disc is a very nice companion bookend to Mystery of the Wax Museum, as are the two films. From our perspective, unconventional horror movies, pre-code crime movies, and they're both very similar thematically. I mean, Mystery of the Wax Museum is very much a thematic sequel to Dr. X. They're completely separate movies, but we have compelling older character actor of great pedigree. We've got Faye Ray, and then you've got Lee Tracy, and then Glenda Farrell playing the hard-boiled reporters. And really, if you want to have a really great double feature, watch them together. What was remarkable about the black and white versus the color version is how similar they are, not just in terms of framing, because I would expect that because Curtiz was a genius, but in terms of the actors, like, being on their marks, delivering the lines, everything the same way, except there's one scene where Lee Tracy, and I'm not going to spoil anything, but there's one scene where Lee Tracy has some fun with an unexpected companion in a closet, and that the scene is played out differently on the two versions. So keep your ear out for that.
You know, this is like a fascinating class in this alternate technology and an alternate form of what is a much more now familiar horror genre. And, you know, like, I guess with Universal, like, they went into the comedy and, like, the, you know, fish out of water in the middle of this horror plot was, like, more done by comedians like Abbott and Costello and stuff later. The color and the mood and the atmosphere is so unique, and it is unseen anywhere else. And so for any horror fan, these are just must-sees in and above anything else. I don't want to spoil anything, but there are some amazing lines that dealt with that. If I was a 90s goth band, I would have sampled and put in my composition.
Well, yeah, and it's fascinating because it is a pre-code Warner Brothers horror film. It yes. has themes and subject matter that no one would go close to hitting for many, many decades. You get serial killing, you get cannibalism, and you have the greatest lineup of unusual suspects maybe ever assembled, because the whole thing hinges on what slightly insane professor of science and medicine is behind it.
And it's a different story than you're used to, in a different form, in a different visual design, and you can't help but be enchanted by it.
Well, for me, this was a revelation, because I think the UCLA folks did a phenomenal job on the restoration. And to see this with such clarity was kind of what I had expected because of the beautiful work they did with Mystery of the Wax Museum. And both films were basically in the same state. Both films existed in a surviving, or in the case of Mystery of the Wax Museum, there were two surviving prints. In the case of Dr. X, there was this one print being rescued that, like all of the Warner Brothers nitrate of the time in the 80s, it went to UCLA for safekeeping because we're not allowed to keep more than 900 feet of nitrate on the lot at any given moment. So UCLA did a photochemical, quote unquote, restoration in the 80s from that print, making a protection dupe negative and so forth and so on. The tools didn't exist to deal with all the damage inherent in the print. All of that changes when you go back to the original print and address all the dirt, all the missing frames were dealt with in the restoration before and after piece that's on the disc and that people can also see on YouTube. You can hear how certain scenes were missing certain lines and how fragments of the film that survived at the Library of Congress were used to fill those missing holes. So it really is a great partnership that we have with UCLA and the Film Foundation. We've worked with UCLA on certain projects like Vitaphone. We've worked with the Film Foundation. Everybody came together on Mystery of the Wax Museum and this to have both films restored to their best possible quality. And of course, the other aspect of two-color Technicolor, which is so important to get right, is two-color Technicolor is not supposed to look natural. It didn't have the ability to look natural because it was a red-green process, and it didn't have the ability to provide a proper blue or proper yellow. As a result, that's why the process was eventually superseded by the three-color process that Technicolor developed, which perfected having more natural color. And at the time that these films were made, the three-color process already had been perfected by Technicolor, but Walt Disney had an exclusive on it, and it started with a 1932 cartoon called Flowers and Trees. And for 3 years, Walt Disney precluded anyone else from using the three-color process. Now, I say that allegedly because we have noticed that there are certain short subjects that were made in late 1934 that were shot in three-color Technicolor. So it kind of jives the history a little bit. But the bottom line of it is that proper three-color Technicolor didn't come to feature films until the film Becky Sharp in 1935. So these two feature films, Dr. X and Mystery of the Wax Museum, were the last two contractual obligations Warner Brothers had to the Technicolor Corporation for the two-color process. And they thought it would be unique, especially spurred on by the huge success that Universal had with Frankenstein and Dracula and the horror genre with films that they were making. And other people were making too as well, but Warner Brothers wanted to seize upon that. One of the most acclaimed of the studio's great golden era directors, Michael Curtiz, to direct both these films. And they really are companion pieces to each other because of the similar casts. And the little featurette that we have on the disc deals with how Michael Curtiz approached horror and even talks about black and white film 1936, The Walking Dead with Boris Karloff, which I hope we can release on Blu-ray someday, because that is a film that deserves an upgrade because it doesn't look very good right now. This is a great disc, a great value. The color is just the way two color Technicolor should look, which is very, very hard to achieve. You have to really know what you're doing as a colorist. And thankfully, the people that worked on this knew what they were doing. They're really wow presentations. They are a collector's dream, really. Because when people saw what these films used to look like, they never thought, or at least I never thought, that I'd get to see them look like this. We're very proud to be bringing this to you, the enthusiast, the collector. It's a beautiful Blu-ray indeed with both movies. And thankfully, the length is short enough that we were able to get a wonderful bitrate with all the material that's on the disc. Nothing is shortchanged, and we think you're going to love it. The next film we're going to talk about does not come from Warner Brothers, but comes from over the hill. It comes from MGM in 1939 and is another Thin Man. William Powell and Myrna Loy as Nick and Nora Charles, the husband and wife detectives we love the most. When we released The Thin Man in 2019, we hoped we'd be able to do the rest of the series, the expense of which was very scary. The prospect was possible if sales were good, and thankfully they were. And we brought you After The Thin Man in January, and now here it is April, and we're bringing you another Thin Man, and the rest of the series will hopefully follow. So, a lot to celebrate. This, I think, continues the excellence of the series. I enjoyed it as much as the first and second films. Gentlemen, what did you think?
Well, you know, it's a Thin Man movie, so I'm not going to try to get into the murder plot, because this one's complicated, and Nick does a lot of walking around and surmising. There's a great scene in Nightclub, but for me, what makes this movie an absolute joy, aside from the fact that it's riffing, I mean, this is actually based on a Dashiell Hammett story, mm-hmm. and he contributed to the story, so it has the same creative DNA as the previous two Thin Man films, mm-hmm. and now we have Parenthood, but more importantly, for me, you have three priceless, priceless supporting characters. You've got Nat Pendleton doing Nat mm-hmm. Pendleton. You have a very early screen appearance, and George, you can even tell me if it's his first screen appearance, of the remarkably talented Sheldon Leonard. And in a hilarious birthday party scene, we have Shemp Howard. So you got Nat.
I love the first three. I love the second three, too, but the first three are near and dear to my heart. And, you know, this is a collectible opportunity if you ever had one. And George, I just remember, you know, since the earliest days of Warner Archive, and this is definitely a testament to the changing in the technology, is like the more popular the film, the more worn the elements, the more difficult and expensive it is to do restorations like the ones we're seeing. But, you know, wow, everything is, you know, you see the results of all that right here in front of you. I can't recommend it more for classics fans.
And to answer your question, this was not Sheldon Leonard's film debut. He had been in some shorts, and he had some bit parts in other movies, but this was his first major role in a movie. Major, minor, you know, I mean, it's a small part.
Showcase.
But an important part.
When Chuck Lorre was getting ready to produce The Big Bang Theory, the characters of Sheldon Cooper and Leonard Hofstadter were his homage to Sheldon Leonard, who was one of the most prolific producers of television sitcoms, including The Dick Van Dyke Show and The Danny Thomas Show, Make Room for Daddy, Andy Griffith Show, Gomer Pyle, and so many more. So just had to throw that in there. But
I don't want to ruin anyone's online discovery, so you should just read up on Sheldon Leonard. But among his many contributions to everything, he's pretty much credited as the guy that came up with the backdoor pilot.
I don't know who did more spinoffs, either he or Norman Lear, but they're probably tied in some way. There's also Virginia Gray, who was a lovely starlet at MGM at the time, Otto Kruger, C. Aubrey Smith, one of my favorite character actresses and semi-leading ladies, Ruth Hussey, is in this. I like the fact that there's a tiny bit part played by Marjorie Main. You know, this is before she had become well-known, quite a year. And speaking of 1939, it's a perfect segue into our next film, which is Each Dawn I Die, which pairs two of the great Warner gangsters, James Cagney and George Raft. And it wasn't often that they would take two heavyweights and put them in the lead of a gangster picture at Warner Brothers. But this is one of those few times they did. I love this movie.
It's not just two heavyweights. It's two childhood friends.
And right. You've got the sets that we've seen before on many prison films, but there wasn't a prison movie like this before. This is so unique,
although
and uniquely told.
It what's interesting is it's a prison film in sort of the bakehouse tradition, mm-hmm. and it's also a gangster film, mm-hmm. because you've got George Raft and James Cagney, and it's being done in a post-code story environment, which means, among other things, had this movie been made before the code, mm-hmm. Cagney might very well have been playing a guilty party. But they had to have the innocent hero. But once he's in the joint, Cagney's is as hardened a criminal as George Raft. And getting to George's point about two heavies, two all-star heavies, originally Cagney was intended to play the gangster, and
John Garfield
was to be the reporter, and then Garfield had to drop out, and then they brought in George Raft, and George Raft was like, Jimmy and I should swap, and he was right, because this is one of Raft's best performances, and it's a great prison film. It's a great crime film, but it's got great twists. Also, as a disc, it looks fantastic, and as a disc, it is packed with supplements,
and it deserves it.
This was one of our Warner Night at the Movies, and we went all out with these. I believe, if my memory serves me correctly, that this is one where we have a newsreel, we have a short subject, we have a cartoon. I mean, it's the whole experience of if you were to go to the movies in 1939.
We even have a breakdowns of 1939.
That's right. The blooper reels the studio made for the Warner Club, which we've talked about often on this podcast, but it's here and looking snazzy. It's just a terrific, terrific disc. And again, this is a 4K scan off the original negative, and it just looks spectacular.
I was a little embarrassed, but I did cry. I cried at the end. I was moved. And I didn't expect that in a gangster movie. And George Raft, his character, Dan, so right for it. And he, because it also had a social justice component,
right,
which made 1939 a reform component.
It's a reform-minded movie, absolutely.
Yeah, but you think like, oh, that's too much stuff. No, it did it in the right balance, in the right way.
Yeah, long before Kevin Bacon made a plea for no more solitary confinement, this movie did the same.
This is, I mean, and again, later movies deal with solitary. I mean, but it had it. And it also has one of my favorite meta theater scenes. How much would you love to go see a movie in that prison movie theater with the machine gun nests, and you got to see a contemporary Warner Brothers picture that everybody is clapping for? I think it was like Wings of something.
Wings of the Navy?
Wings of the Navy.
1939.
Which just happens to be a Warner Archive release.
Yeah. And I was like, I was clapping too. And then, of course, terrible crime happens in the dark. I don't want to ruin anything. But It's got everything and more, and fantastic if you've never seen it. Even better if you've seen it before, because you've never seen it like this.
In short, Cagney is a crusading reporter. He's framed by a corrupt DA. And in the big house, he becomes friends with a unrepentant criminal, George Raft. And between the two of them and their burgeoning friendship, justice is restored.
You've never learned so much about forced prison labor with twine before in your life.
It was fascinating watching that, but that is a super
twine
tangent.
Machine is so cool. Okay, the end.
And that might be mean it's time to betwine the betwine.
Woo!
Well, if we're going to betwine those betwine, does that mean that you want to begin the begin?
That was what I was alluding to.
Okay, well, I picked up on that. That's great.
I got it.
It's very rare that a sequence in a movie is more famous than the original film it came from. But I think that is the case where a number in the film is better known than the name of the film itself, where it came from. And there are multiple reasons for this. But the Begin finale with Eleanor Powell and Fred Astaire dancing together from Broadway Millie of 1940 is probably one of the most memorable musical numbers ever put on film. And certainly one of the most, taking Busby Berkeley aside, one of the most amazing black and white numbers ever produced, because it just shimmers and shines. And what gave this an extra oomph, because I think it had been probably a little bit forgotten beforehand, was they featured this clip of that number early in the running time of That's Entertainment in 1974, which introduced a whole new audience of people to MGM musicals. And I don't think people today in 2021 can recognize the impact that That's Entertainment had in 1974 as the sixth highest grossing movie of that year, filling theaters with people of all ages seeing clips from MGM musicals. They had the Begin number, and they ran the end part of it without editing. Most of the numbers in the That's Entertainment films were all very slickly edited so that the running time would not lag. And this is the second part of the Begin number, but it's the jazzy part. And Begin the Begin had been a hit record for Artie Shaw the year before, 1939. And this is very much in the style of the Artie Shaw recording. And their dancing is amazing. And Frank Sinatra is hosting that first sequence as they're showing a few clips from MGM musicals. And Sinatra says, "You can wait around and hope, but I tell you, you'll never see the likes of this again. And truer words were never spoken." The film itself is actually a wonderful film, and it was the last in the series of Broadway Melody movies that MGM made. They made The Broadway Melody in 1929, which was the Best Picture Oscar winner of its time. And it was not until 1935 that they started the Broadway Melody franchise by making Broadway Melody of 1936, but it's so good they had to release it a year earlier or something like that, it says in the trailer. But Eleanor Powell was in that film along with Robert Taylor, and then there was Broadway Melody of 1938 with Eleanor Powell and Robert Taylor, and very notable appearance by Judy Garland. And then Fred Astaire had recently ended his tenure under contract to RKO, and he was a free agent. And he made the trip to Culver City to co-star with the Queen of Tap, Eleanor Powell, in Broadway Melody of 1940, which also stars, don't want to give him short shrift, future Senator of California, George Murphy. And he does a mighty good job dancing with the two of them at the end of the movie. And Even the number that Fred Astaire has with George Murphy, Don't Monkey with Broadway, Please Don't Monkey with Broadway is the actual name of the song, is pretty impressive, because keeping up with Fred Astaire was not easy to do.
Best senatorial dancer? I mean,
yes.
And future president recruiter.
Yeah.
I think, well, it's very interesting you say that, because I remember when I was a child, you'll appreciate this, Matt. WOR was having a George Murphy week, and they said, this week we're featuring the song and dance senator on Million Dollar Movie. And I was like,
yes.
And I was probably the only 8-year-old that had a copy of his autobiography. Say, didn't you used to be George Murphy? This film is, classic MGM players. You got Frank Morgan, Lynn Carver, a good supporting cast. And most notably, the scores for the other Broadway Melody films were written by the songwriting team of Arthur Freed and Nisho Herb-Brown. And in 1939, Arthur Freed cut his teeth as a producer without credit, as an associate producer on The Wizard of Oz, and then produced his first film as a credited producer, Babes in Arms. So it fell to another composer to write the score for Broadway Melody in 1940, and it happened to be a gentleman by the name of Cole Porter. And Cole Porter had written the music for Born to Dance, which Eleanor Powell starred in 1936 with James Stewart. That's the film that introduced Easy to Love. For Broadway Melody of 1940, Cole Porter penned a number of very memorable songs, some of which became standards, most notably I Concentrate on You. But Begin the Begin was not written for Broadway Melody of 1940. It was written for a Broadway show in 1935 called Jubilee, which was a failure. But the song Begin the Begin lived on and then became a huge hit thereafter. And MGM had backed Jubilee, hoping to make it into a movie, not knowing it was going to be a bomb. So they were able to rescue Begin the Begin to use in Broadway Melody of 1940. So there's a little trivia on there, folks, but this is a basic Broadway backstage story. And gentlemen, I would like to hear your thoughts of the scenario and the roles of the, as it were.
It's definitely the most interesting adaptation of Cyrano de Bergerac anyone's ever made.
I never thought of it that way.
Yeah. Oh, it's right there.
Only
we solve it with tap instead of fencing.
Of course, as George was saying before, I can't get a future senator out of my head.
So just to explain for the people, the plot hinges around George Murphy and Fred Astaire are dance partners, and due to a misunderstanding, Frank Morgan's trying to hire Fred Astaire, but he accidentally hires George Murphy, which pairs George Murphy with Eleanor Powell in a show. And Fred plays Cyrano to George in trying to help his friend. But of course, like Cyrano, he's in love with the lady. And also what's remarkable about this film, aside from the fact that it looks fantastic, Eleanor Powell is transcendent in terms of dance. And her pairing with Fred Astaire is a remarkably sublime piece of this era of Hollywood. I mean, just their scenes alone make the film worth it. But the film is actually wonderfully entertaining with really great. I mean, it's Cole Porter, so I don't need to sing his praises.
But this is one of those moments where the behind the stage story works and the music works and the dancing is unequal. Like, this is like the Olympics of classic dancing.
And what's really exciting for me is This we had out on DVD many, many years ago, and it was part of a Cole Porter box set, I think around 2003. This is one of those films where the original negative burnt in the fire, and we were using the safety fine grain as our film source, but we found a nitrate element. It was either found overseas or someplace domestically. I don't exactly remember what archive had it, but we were able to scan this nitrate element at 4K, and it needed a lot of cleanup. It has to be done by hand, and it takes forever, but we had to get it perfect, and I think we did. I hope we did, but the begin-to-begin number looks so amazing, and you think about this. It cost $125,000 just to film that one number. Now, if you take that in to $1,940 to $2,021, I think that would be a couple of million. This film was initially penciled in to be shot in Technicolor because MGM was warming up to Technicolor. They obviously had just made The Wizard of Oz, and Technicolor had been used in a few other films. And they started shooting right as World War II broke out in Europe. And they realized they were going to lose the European market. So they decided to play it a little safer and keep it in black and white. But I think that works to its benefit because that finale wouldn't be the same in color. There's something about its black and whiteness that just works for me. And I don't know if it's because I grew up with it and I know it that well, but I think it's just magnificent.
It's a wonderful way of showing off what black and white can do at this period and still compete. It's wonderful.
My dear friend, the late Ann Miller, hosted a little featurette we put together about the making of the movie because, as she used to say about Eleanor Powell, she's my good friend. But Eleanor Powell actually was an inspiration to Annie. When she was a teenager, Eleanor Powell was her idol. They were about 10 years apart in age, I'd say, or so. Nonetheless, the featurette is a nice little insight into the making of the film, the background of the film, and some people talking about its place in film history. It's finally out on Blu-ray, and I know a lot of people were really thrilled when we announced all of these April titles got a huge charge from consumers when they heard that they were coming out. Everything was welcomed by different groups of people, and that's one of the things I like is when we're able to be able to bring a diverse group of kinds of films from different genres, different periods, because there's so many different aspects of our fan base. That's what the Warner Archive is about. Rare and hard to find in Blu-ray on this movie. Couldn't find it at all. There was no high definition master. It's not like the case of, let's say, the next film we're gonna talk about. There was an HD master that was made 10 years ago, but it wasn't up to our standards. So we had to start again and create something brand new. So now there is. And our next film comes from 1947, and it has a very interesting pedigree. This is Green Dolphin Street, and this was directed by Victor Saville. And it was released in 1947, huge box office success, won an Oscar for special effects. It was nominated for a few more. Big stars in the film, Lana Turner playing the unattractive sister, which I just never, I had trouble with that. And Donna Reed was considered the more attractive sister. And it's set in New Zealand. It's about a case of mistaken identity due to alcohol consumption. The leading man was a man by the name of Richard Hart, who passed away shortly after this film was made. I think he was in a car accident or some kind of tragedy that just as his career was beginning, it ended. But he's quite good in the film. It has sweeping storytelling. And what made it special was that MGM decided after the war to have a novel writing contest. And the winner would get $100,000, which is a lot of money back then. It's not exactly chicken feed now, but $100,000 and they'd get their book made into a film. It did go on to be a bestseller. The authoress's name was Elizabeth Googe. The film went on to be a huge, huge success. Very popular with audiences. I love this film also because of the sterling supporting cast. You have Gladys Cooper and Edmund Gwenn and Dame Mae Whitty. Wonderful supporting cast. The special effects of the, there's basically an earthquake. We talked about earthquake in San Francisco. This is 10 years later. There's a tribal revolution. There's warfare. There's fear. There's all sorts of drama. But the performances are terrific. I think the film is very captivating and entertaining. And I would be remiss not to call out one of the other stars, which we haven't talked about, who we've spoken of very highly before on these podcasts, and that's Van Heflin. He's the guy who's in love with Lana Turner, but they can't quite get it together. And it's a very interesting way that weaves into the plot. And I think he's terrific in the film. Gentlemen, what did you think of Green Dolphin Street?
Dan, the story and the backstory have so much to it that it's hard to keep it brief. It's an epic.
It is definitely an epic. It's often, even in the marketing of the time, they try to position it in the same sort of consciousness as Gone with the Wind. But it's actually quite different. I mean, they're both epics, and they're both. And here's the interesting thing that I don't think they were trying when they were making that comparison. I think they were just going for sweeping epic. But they're both anti-romances disguised as romances.
Yeah, it has this like almost like Willa Cather like feeling to it.
If you liked Ethan Frome, you'll love Green Dolphin Street. And then there's a quadrangle, but there's also an older love story that informs the younger love story. And there's very much so. It's a young love versus grown up love is the theme of the film. And the film is very much you don't get what you want, but you get what you need. And the film ends on some very, from a literary standpoint, the way the film opens and the way the film ends is a lovely Romana Clef circle of life thing. And also, Van Heflin, he's so dark and he's so driven. And it's just funny watching this so soon after watching Tennessee Jackson. Because... you know, it's like, wow, Van Heflin was really like, you're the supporting heavy. Okay. He's so unlike the other actors in the film, but it all works, and he's terrific to watch. And, yeah, this is one of Lana's best performances, but it is hilarious seeing her play the bookish one.
It has this epic Game of Thrones-like feel. Yep. And so one of the reasons is it takes people and their romances and their power plays and their economic structures and society building and civilization to exotic corners of the globe at a time of economic change. Just the fact that this is probably like the only movie that, you know, studio movie that takes place on the island of Guernsey, which is like a principality of England, like right off France and the Channel Coast, which has a bizarre history in and of itself, and it features a nunnery that you can only walk out to in low tide, which those castles exist, and you can visit them in Cornwall, which I did, which is freaking fascinating, and there's one in Normandy, which they built a road, so it's cheating, but you actually have to, those are real places, you have to time going out, and you can be literally swept away by the tide, because it was a defensive measure, like a moat. And then they go to New Zealand. Who sets an adventure movie in New Zealand? This movie did, and it had the Maori and the colonialism and then the problems with that, and it's like a Western, and then the steamships. It's insane. And then, as Dan talked about, the romance, and you put it all together, it is truly epic. And I don't know... I don't hear a lot of people talking about this movie. This is a really one, if it isn't on your radar, put it on your radar.
It's interesting. I remember reading an article years and years later where Donna Reed was talking about her career. Mm-hmm. And then when she was offered the role of the sister, Marguerite, she refused to take the part because she didn't believe that anyone would think she was the prettier sister than Lana Turner. She thought Lana Turner was like the most beautiful woman on the MGM lot, and no one would believe that Donna Reed was more attractive. But she didn't realize that, of course, they were both beautiful, and that's what made it so interesting. There are lines specifically in the film which are what we now talk about as female empowerment. Mm-hmm. But, you know, her father chastises her for her knowledge of mm-hmm. business. Yeah. There are those little squibs of the misogyny that mm-hmm. was buried within film as acceptable, you know, but saying that a woman can't do that because that requires too much business knowledge. You can't do that. You know, I find that as offensive as other people find certain other things in older movies offensive. But I look at it as a product of its time and the way people really did think in that period of time.
And as a product of its time, it is pro. You know, it says that she can do it and she deserved,
and
you know,
she did do it.
Yeah, a seat at the table. And that's what makes it maybe like not 1937, but, you know, after the war, right? Because women had gone into the workplace and had proven themselves. And unfortunately, later they were going to be stuck in the suburbs. But this is like kind of representing that moment.
Well, when we talk about women, defying gender stereotyping was really one of the earliest examples of that in pop culture of the 1800s is Annie Oakley and her ability to be a sharpshooter and to go up against any man and win in sharpshooting contests. And she, it's basically based on a true story because Annie Oakley was a real person. They did make a movie about her life with Barbara Stanwyck. They took her life story and made it into a stage musical in 1946, starring Ethel Merman. And Irving Berlin wrote the music. And the book was written by the brother and sister team of Herbert and Dorothy Fields. And it was a massive success, produced for the Broadway stage by Rodgers and Hammerstein. They were so busy writing their own shows, they said, well, let's do something for Irving, who had been a popular songwriter at that point for 35 years. And a couple of years before, he had written a tune called White Christmas. It wasn't exactly like he had been forgotten, but this was the first time he had written a book musical where the songs propelled the plot in the style that Rodgers and Hammerstein developed to a new level with shows like Oklahoma. So it was a massive stage hit, and MGM bought the rights, and Arthur Freed was going to produce the film. And naturally, they decided they would make the movie with their biggest musical star, Judy Garland, playing Annie Oakley. And to play opposite her, they hired a very little-known American actor who had done one English film a few years before, which is ironic, given he had such a powerful voice, and that was Howard Keel. And Howard Keel was signed to an MGM contract to play opposite Judy Garland. Judy Garland was not well when this film was put into production. To basically add insult to injury, Arthur Freed wanted to do something for his friend Busby Berkeley, who had directed Mickey and Judy in three of their four musicals. Babes in Arms, Babes on Broadway, Strike Up the Band. He only did the I've Got Rhythm sequence for Girl Crazy. Judy Garland was not well at the time Annie Get Your Gun began production. While Garland was filming her initial footage, Howard Keel became unavailable for several weeks of shooting. So most of the responsibility fell to Judy, coming in late, missing days, and she had to be replaced on the film. So the film went on hiatus, and Arthur Freed had to find a new Annie. And they considered a lot of different people and decided to go to Paramount Pictures. They watched The Perils of Pauline, which Betty Hutton had made in 1947, which was a big hit, and decided that she would be the ideal person to play Annie Oakley. And so Judy was out, and a couple of months later, production began with Betty Hutton as Annie Oakley, and Howard Keel, of course, back as Frank Butler. But Colonel Buffalo Bill was originally going to be played by Frank Morgan, which would have been a reunion of Dorothy and the Wizard. It would have been the first time that Frank Morgan worked with Judy Garland since The Wizard of Oz. And unfortunately, Frank Morgan was unexpectedly stricken by a heart attack and died during the break of production. So the role of Colonel Buffalo Bill ended up being played by stalwart MGM supporting player Louis Calhern. Once production got underway, they had also changed directors, and they ended up with George Sidney directing. And with George Sidney directing and a few other cast changes, some of the kids had gotten too big to play little kids, production finally got underway again, and it was pretty much smooth sailing there forward. The film was a huge box office success, got great reviews. So very little of the true story made it to the screenplay by the time Sidney Sheldon of Other Side of Midnight and other trashy novel fame wrote the screenplay to this movie, just as he had for Easter Parade. So one other interesting thing about this film is that when it came time for the underlying copyright renewal of the show in 1974, Irving Berlin basically didn't want the film in distribution anymore, and it was out of distribution for 26 years. You couldn't see it on television, you couldn't rent it, you couldn't see it in theaters. It was not available on home video, and it wasn't until the year 2000 we were finally able to make a deal with the Irving Berlin estate and the estate of the heirs of Herbert and Dorothy Fields to finally free the film up for its 50th anniversary. And we had a screening at the Academy with George Sidney in attendance, with Sidney Sheldon in attendance, with Howard Keel in attendance. And we tried desperately to get Betty Hutton to come. And she'd say yes, and she'd say no, and she'd say yes, and she'd say no. And ultimately, she did not show up. But it was a magnificent evening at the Academy, and a lot of Hollywood royalty was there. A lot of people involved in the production were still around. It was a great night. And now it's 21 years later, and we have remastered the film, 4K scan off the original camera negative. And there are two reels of the camera negative that burned in the Eastman House fire. And we had to use positive safety separations that were made for protection for those sections that burned. So if you see the film change a little bit, that's why. However, the change is barely noticeable because MPI did such an amazing job on the remaster of the film. Then, if that's not enough, we have a bunch of extras that are quite fascinating. We have Judy Garland's two musical numbers that she filmed before she left the picture. Doing What Comes Naturally and I'm an Indian Too are both presented with Judy in the Annie garb, so you can see what her performance would have been like. And we also have the Colonel Buffalo Bill opening number with Frank Morgan dressed as Colonel Buffalo Bill. All that footage survived. Thankfully, MGM saved it. We have it on the disc. And then there was a song that Judy Garland was going to sing that wasn't in the Broadway production. Allegedly, it was cut out of the Broadway production Out of Town. I've also heard that it was written for Judy to sing in the movie, but it's a ballad called Let's Go West Again. That was cut out of the movie when Betty Hutton sang it. And that's on the disc also. And then in addition, we have some audio pre-recordings, including Judy's attempt to sing There's No Business Like Show Business and screwing up the lyrics a couple of times. And it's a lot of fun. And we left it just as it was recorded because you can hear her laughing and apologizing. And there's no sensibility when you listen to this that she wasn't having a good time. And that's why we put that on there, as well as you get to hear the, in stereo, no less, the pre-recordings of Colonel Buffalo Bill and Let's Go West Again. The sound is great. The picture looks amazing. And finally, this Broadway classic, we've gone full circle. 21 years later, after the DVD release, we now have a beautiful Blu-ray 4K scan off the Technicolor Elements, and great color, great sound, great performances, great songs, so many hit songs, great extras. Gentlemen, what did you think of Annie Get Your Gun?
I have one question for you, George. Now, you know, we don't have many of these, but I can only get this on Blu-ray and DVD. Is that the case with this film?
That is, well, you can see it on TV.
Right.
But this is one of those films where it's not available digitally.
Yeah, because I was like, oh, I want to compare it digitally, but I couldn't find it. And I'm like, wait a minute. There's a little bit of mystery to this. So physical media fans, this is your day to shine.
So I don't know if we
can't say that.
We can. I don't know if we want to, because
they can't get it any other way.
Well, but the thing is, there is discussion ongoing right now to try to get the digital rights. So
right. Well, I would. So right now, I mean, it's just, well, anybody can find.
Let's phrase it differently. Why don't you start your point again?
I'll ask
without.
Okay.
So this way we don't get people yelling at us.
So, George, I have a question on this one. I went to search for it digitally to maybe, you know, compare it to the DVD, because I don't have the DVD. I wanted to look at the improvement, but I couldn't find it. Is that the case with this right now? It's only on disc?
At this point in time, it is only available on disc or on linear television. It's not available digitally. That could change in the future. But at the present time, the only way that you can own the film is through physical media. And on Blu-ray, the only way you can get better than Blu-ray is 4K. And these kind of films really haven't found their way to 4K yet. And look, we're just getting to Blu-ray after 21 years of being just on DVD. And Blu-ray has been around for 15 years. So it's a long time coming. And I'm delighted that it's on Blu-ray.
This master on Blu-ray is so luscious, just like Million Dollar Mermaid was. You don't need a 4K. This one will already melt your eyebrows with resolution and color. It looks remarkably good. It was also really great to sort of see it in this batch of films, because you have all, you know, if you got Nitrate and some of them restored and the two-strip, and they all look so good. And then coming off of like Broadway Melody and that scene, and then Green Dolphin Street's epic staging, but also its theatricality. And then you get into Annie Get Your Gun, which is both musically staged and widescreen with big colors. It's really fantastic. I mean, just the scene alone where Frank Butler and Annie Oakley are having their initial gun duel and they're shooting the clay pigeons in the air. It's a long shot where you've got clarity from foreground to deep, deep background, and you've got bright colors. You can even see little bits of shrapnel while the smoke. I mean, just technically, the film looks better, I bet, than it ever has. And then, of course, you know, it is the show business film.
Absolutely. I mean, there's no business like show business is the anthem to entertainment. Performance of it is just, it's kind of charming because it's not this huge, big production number. It is at the end.
Right.
For the finale. I really like the way they staged that and the way she gets so excited about it. It's songs that came out of this film. They say it's wonderful. My defenses are down. There's just so many great songs. And of course, you can't get a man with a gun. Takes on a little bit of a different meaning now, but not in an offensive way. And, I think it's really, really wonderful that this film is now out and available and people can enjoy it, looking fabulous on Blu-ray. Now, our next film thrusts us into the future by 40 years, and a film that was released in 1990 that stars Bill Murray, who co-directed the film with a gentleman by the name of Howard Franklin, who wrote the screenplay. The film is Quick Change, based on a novel by Jay Cronley that was written in 1981. And originally it was made into a French film with Jean-Paul Belmondo and Kim Cattrall. It caught the eye of Bill Murray, and he was very interested in the project. And this was his first developing his own project for film, and he put a lot of himself in it. He co-stars with Gina Davis, fresh off her Oscar-winning supporting role in The Accidental Tourist, and everybody's favorite cousin Eddie, Randy Quaid. And little-known actor Jason Robards Jr. I saw this film in the theater, and I loved it. And it had a pretty wide release. It was not a hit when it came out. This is one of those films that, thanks to home video and HBO, developed an audience. And this is one of the most requested films that we have been asked about through social media and correspondence from the fans. They want Quick Change on Blu-ray. We hereby deliver the brand new master that looks gorgeous. I enjoyed the film more than I had when I saw it originally. Gentlemen, what did you think of Quick Change?
Aside from its enormous comedy pedigree in the development of Bill Murray, the artist, and, you know, he produced and co-directed, and it has a lot of, I don't know the adjectival form of Bill Murray yet, Murray-esque, Murrayan, but what's really kind of fascinating about the film, aside from, and the film was peppered with amazing appearances by people who weren't famous yet, but were going to be and still are, like Tony Shalhoub and Stanley Tucci. But and the film is definitely one of the best dystopian New York movies ever made. Mm-hmm. But the thing that really cracks me up about the film is, you know, it is such a great capture of the feel of that period of New York.
At the time, you know, like with the Warriors and these other ones, especially the outer boroughs were more foreboding, because it's like at least Manhattan's on a grid. The moment, there are two wonderful moments in the film that people who've seen it, it never escapes them. One involves Flowers of the Dead, and the other involves a jousting tournament that is better seen than described. It freaks out the characters as much as you. This is a journey in and of itself. And also it shows you how much different airport security truly is.
I think that, you know, Bill Murray has done so much wonderful work in his career, you know, Lost in Translation. And then, you know, even going back to Caddyshack and Ghostbusters and all those kinds of things. Even Meatballs. I mean, you know, he's had such a varied career and he's still working. I just think this film had trouble finding a mainstream audience at the time. Maybe it was the marketing. I don't really know why it didn't catch on in the theater. You know, we're able to look at a lot of these movies now. We've talked about this before. Mm-hmm. Films that didn't catch fire at the box office that now are fan favorites and have sold, you know, multiple thousands of copies and digital downloads and rentals, and, you know, that have become part of the zeitgeist of American pop culture with great fondness and big followings. And I think that is because it isn't just what you could catch in the theater. And that's still true today. As a matter of fact, it's more true than ever because the way people are getting their media is changing on a daily basis. But this is a film that belongs on Blu-ray, and the colors pop. The new master is just beautiful. It's a huge leap forward from what you've seen on TV in the past. And this is one that we really wanted to make all the beautiful parts of New York look beautiful, and the parts that hadn't been cleaned up yet look as they did. And I think the new master really does a great job with that. So
just make sure you bring exact change. That's all I'm saying.
That wraps up the movies for this podcast, but wait, there's more. We've got an animated television series to talk about from the fantastic world of Hanna-Barbera and originally created for the Archie Comics company. We have Josie and the Pussycats, this time in outer space. Josie and the Pussycats first landed on Saturday mornings in CBS Cartoon-Rama in 1970. And Hanna-Barbera decided to create a new series in 1972, 2 years later, with most of the same voice cast, and have Josie and the Pussycats go in outer space. And there are 16 episodes. They were broadcast originally in the fall and fall and early winter of 1972. Stayed on Saturday morning for quite a while and then went into syndication. And we put this out on DVD from the existing masters when we were first starting to exhume Hanna-Barbera rarities. And now to have beautiful HD remasters on Blu-ray is a delight for the fans. What do you think, guys?
I wouldn't watch Josie and the Pussycats because to me, it was Archie. And that was like a teenage show. And I didn't like teenage shows. But once they were in outer space, I had to go to watch. So this is definitely appointment Saturday morning for me as a very young child, and to watch the Blu-ray. And it's really funny because, you know, it's both, I mean, it's wonderful to have it in this format. It's also wonderful. The songs are actually really good. They're great pieces of bubblegum pop, and it's really nice to hear them sounding this good. And then it is also funny because this is Hanna-Barbera continuing to move in a way so they can continue to produce cartoons. So the animation is limited and you get these beautiful colors and the beautiful brush strokes. But also thanks to the Blu-ray, you're really able to see in the background. It's like also George Lucas, we know where you got R2, and everyone thinks it was Silent Running, but it's bleep.
Nope. It is. Bleep is fully developed and people can, a few people can understand it, some more than others, and have conversations with it. And of course, there is a greatest role for a cat is to be overshadowed by a creature called Bleep, as nature intended it. I put this on because I remember revisiting it when we had the DVD. And I accidentally watched 5 episodes on the Blu-ray. So hats off. It is a part of my childhood, so okay. But I don't know, you know, like of all the in-space reboots, which sound like it was pitched off the top of someone's head, this is kind of my favorite one. Dan, question, serious question. Do you prefer the In Space lyrics or the original lyrics?
Oh, that's a great question, because it's funny. People are having this argument as we speak.
Are they?
On our YouTube channel.
As they should.
And people are insisting that we release Outer Space, but replace the opening song with the original song and not the Outer Space version.
Oh, that is blasphemy.
I'm going to please no one who likes to fight. They're both great.
They are both great. I agree with that. The space one, I feel, is overlooked. I feel that, and so when you hear it, it's surprising because it feels in a way like it's being translated from another language. Like you're like it goes against your expectations and surprises. It surprises you because it's so familiar, yet you're unfamiliar with it. So.
I don't know.
Our YouTube page and listen. You know, if you're going to accidentally launch a group into space, which has been done, this is the one you want to launch into space and send as ambassadors from planet Earth.
We should also mention that in addition to the 8 new to Blu-rays we're putting out in April, we also have Blu-rays returning to print that were out of print that are back in print, and both of them are darn good looking, and they both also happen to be what I would call Academy Award winning best pictures. We have Mutiny on the Bounty, the original film from MGM with Clark Gable and Charles Laughton and French O'Tone from 1935. It looks fantastic, came off the original camera negative, and that disc originally came out about 9 years ago, but it still looks fresh as a daisy. And there's some very, very nice supplements with it. And then we have 1981's Best Picture Oscar winner, Chariots of Fire, which is Hugh Hudson's film that was a surprise hit and certainly a surprise winner at the 1981 Academy Awards, and it's a favorite. I also have very fond memories of the spoof of it they did on SCTV, Chariots of Eggs, but unfortunately that is not on our disc. But anyway, those round out, so we actually have 10 releases for April. But now is the time in the Warner Archive podcast where we have communiques from you. They used to be letters before the pandemic, but now they're emails. And it's where you get to email us and ask us questions, and we read them and answer them. So without further ado, Matt, what do we have in store?
Matt doesn't have anything.
You forget. It's Dan.
Okay, I'll say that again. Where you, the consumer, send communiques. Where you, the consumer, send communiques to us, and they've been via email They've been on email post pandemic, so that you could reach us, since none of us have been working in the office for a very, very long time. But we have a bunch of emails, and Dan has them, and I am anxious to hear them.
We have so many. I just want to apologize to the people that wrote, because this has already been a very long discussion. So I am going to edit your queries as I speak. If I do you a disservice, I apologize without any pause. Here's the first one from Richard and George. I'm going to take this one because I can. Richard wants to know if there are any plans for further seasons of Head of the Class, and the answer is yes. Now we have a question from Matt. It's been a few years since I sent in a question to the podcast. Your Blu-ray slate for the past few months has been extraordinary, and I've had trouble keeping up with so many great releases. Keep up the good work. We both know not every film is big enough to get a Blu-ray release, but I think every film is deserving of a DVD release. A notion I think is exemplified by WAC. Thank you. Here are a few titles that are MIA that I'm curious about. Okay, so now over to George. He asks about The Macomber Affair, King Lear, 1970, and Terror in the City, a.k.a. Pie in the Sky, 1964.
Two of those are not asked about very much. We're still trying to figure out the right situation on Terror in the City, a.k.a. Pie in the Sky, because it crosses libraries, because Allied Artists had some involvement in it, and so did Seven Arts. That's one of the films that we've been trying to find the right files to determine our rights. So we haven't been able to rectify that yet. But we like to come up with these things that are surprising and interesting. The Macomber Affair is a film where we actually didn't have the rights to distribute it for a very, very long time due to underlying clearance issues. We did clear the film for a brief period of time, and we're hoping to remaster and release it when we ran into Film Element problems. And then by the time we thought we were getting closer to solving the Film Element problems, the film was not clear for us to release again. So it's in limbo at the moment. I don't really have anything to say in terms of what's going to happen. These are very, very complicated motion pictures, so that's very impressive. The 1970 version of King Lear is not owned by Warner Brothers. It is not part of our library. It belongs to another studio, so we can't release it. So I can't say anything about that. I think Pie in the Sky and Terror in the City is something that I was trying to solve years and years ago and ran into so many roadblocks because the documentation is so inconclusive. We do have Film Elements, but then again, you have to weigh, well, how many people are going to buy this movie that nobody's ever heard of? And is it any good? And frankly, I would like to be able to see it. And I haven't been able to do that. So excellent question, but it is on our radar.
Okay, so here's one from Dylan. Dear Warner Archive Podcast. Dear Warner Archive Podcast, I have to extend my appreciation for all the joy you brought in 2020. And for starting off 2021 with a bang, with classics such as After the Thin Man, to animated gems such as Space Ghosts and cult favorites like Drop Dead Gorgeous, your releases have covered a wide variety of interests. For his inquiry today, he's going to limit himself to 4 titles for himself and 4 for his wife. So he inquires about any chance of getting Animaniacs on Blu-ray. What about Tenacious D and Pick of Destiny or David Mamet's Spartan? That's only 4. The other question is about a title I know we don't have the rights of. And then his wife asks about A Walk to Remember, Sisterhood of the Traveling Pants. I worked on that website. Must Love Dogs and Divine Secrets of the Ya-Ya Sisterhood.
Well, none of those are planned, but some of them are under discussion.
Question from Andre. He is wondering if the Charles Bronson films Telephone and St. Ives are under consideration for Blu-ray.
It's possible for the future, but as of now, there are no plans.
Here is a question from Sean. Good morning. I heard about the podcast a couple months ago and have listened to many, many episodes since then. It's been great to hear about the Warner Archives production process and all the titles included therein. Among many classics, I'm wondering specifically if Friendly Persuasion might be an upcoming release. I would also snatch up A Date with Judy, The Nun Story, Butterfield 8, Splendor in the Grass, Late in the Piazza, A Summer Place, and, well, a host of many others. I plan on buying a plethora of classics the next time there is a sale. I'm so glad Mr. Feldenstein is still activity. I should guess he means involved in ensuring classic titles are coming out in Blu-ray and DVD. I've been an appreciative fan since the early days of DVD when I became aware George was the driving force behind terrific restorations and deluxe editions of classic movies which never disappointed. The Adventures of Robin Hood, Treasure of Sierra Madre, Meet Me in St. Louis, etc. Sincerely, Sean.
Well, thank you, Sean. We really, really appreciate that. All the films that you mentioned are likely. None of them are in the works at the moment. They're likely contenders for future releases. Not like at the back of the list, but more toward the front.
Now we have a question from Michael, who's asking about the television pilot Black Bart was included in the Blazing Saddles release. This was an attempt by the studio because of how contracts were worded that allowed the studio to plan a sequel to Blazing Saddles Warner Brothers continued to make episodes despite never airing them in order to keep the sequel option viable. Would it be possible to have a DVD release of all the unaired episodes?
I actually don't know if that's true or not.
Yeah, what I was going to say is the internet thinks there are all these episodes, but to my knowledge, it was actually only the pilot and the rest is...
That is my understanding, and I don't have our inventory at my fingertips, so I can't answer that question definitively, but I'm 99% sure that it's like those episodes of Chuck Norris's Karate Commandos. There were never more than five, and right. yet there were, you know, scripts for 26 or something.
Okay, this is from Larry. Dear Whack, can you say if there are any new-to-blue 1970s or 1980s theatrical titles scheduled to release in 2021? For those of us who love 70s films, this was a very dry period. The last new-to-70s was A Little Romance. Many thanks, Larry.
Well, A Little Romance just came out, what, a year ago? This is an important point you know, we try to please everybody, and when we please one group of people, we disappoint another. And there was a very vocal group of people that were bemoaning the fact that we weren't releasing anything that was from the 1930s or 40s, and we weren't releasing anything that was black and white. We weren't releasing anything that was Academy ratio, that we were only releasing CinemaScope movies. So now there are people complaining about the fact they were not releasing 70s and 80s movies when for a while that's all we were doing. There is room for everything. And with a library as rich and vast as ours, the potential is frankly endless. And we have lots of contenders. I know we have at least a few from both the 70s and 80s in production right now. So we're not neglecting the decades. We're just doing the best we can with the world's greatest and largest film library.
All right, here is questions from Josh. Greetings. First off, I just want to say that I absolutely love the work you're doing with the podcast and that of Warner Archive as a whole. It's incredibly important, vital work, and I hope it can continue for many years to come. I was hoping you could answer on the podcast if WAC has any plans to restore and release Alfred Hitchcock's Stage Fright on Blu-ray. It's conspicuously absent from the format, and I've been waiting for years. I'd also be interested to hear if any Joan or Betty titles are in the works. Particularly, I'd love to see Autumn Leaves and Evan Crawford's Trog. Thank you, Josh.
Well, I can tell you we can't release Autumn Leaves because we don't own it. It belongs to another studio. There is good news on Stage Fright, although the work has yet to begin. Stage Fright was approved for restoration from the Nitron Camera negative for 2021. Work has not begun. They haven't pulled the negative yet from UCLA where the nitrate is stored. So we don't know what's ahead of us. We can start on a project and find that we're in trouble. I hope that doesn't happen, but I can say that it is on the list. It was approved for the process to begin. I can say with pretty much certainty that if it comes out this year, it would be at the end of the year and most likely will be for 2022. But it is very much, it's clearly an omission when you have, we have two Hitchcock films that are not on Blu-ray, Mr. and Mrs. Smith and Stage Fright. And I know everybody wants both of them, but Mr. and Mrs. Smith is an oddity given that it is a romantic comedy and not a Hitchcock thriller. So we do one thing at a time. Right now we're focusing on Stage Fright. Hopefully we'll be able to make that happen. So the news is good on that one and I'm glad to impart it.
Next question is from Jordan. And George, I can answer half of this. He's asking if there's any hope for Clarence Brown's The Yearling and The Human Comedy on Blu-ray anytime soon. Jordan, I can tell you that by the time you hear this, most likely The Yearling will have been announced. But Human Comedy, I have to turn to George.
Well, Human Comedy is a possibility for the future. But yes, Dan is right about The Yearling. And best of all, The Yearling is a brand new 4K scan off the original nitrate camera negative. And it looks amazing.
Next question is from Michael. I love this question. This is clearly a Steve McQueen man. Hello, I was just curious if we may ever see two of Steve McQueen's final films, An Enemy of the People, available from Warner Archive, and Tom Horn, released on Blu-ray from Warner Archive. And how about the Frisco Kid with Gene Wilder and Harrison Ford? Thank you, Mike.
All of them are possibilities. I would say it's very likely that we'll see Tom Horn and the Frisco Kid. Little less likely that an enemy of the people will make it soon. Certainly, Tom Horn and Frisco Kid have been at the top of the list of things to do.
This is from Ben. He says, go about stage fright on Blu-ray, Cast a Crooked Shadow, That's Dancing, and Cats Don't Dance.
Interesting. No plans for Cast a Crooked Shadow, although our DVD looks really good. But that's not in the cards at the moment. Nor is Cats Don't Dance. I really would love to do That's Dancing because I think it needs to be done. There is an HD master that was done for DVD that looks really not great. And the problem with a film like that is that it is a compendium of clips from 60 or 70 different films. And unlike the That's Entertainment films, which presented their own problems, That's Dancing is a history of dance on film. So it has clips of films that we don't own. So it would involve our having to go to other studios to try to get better materials for those sequences. And it would be really, really expensive to make it look great. I hope someday that we'll get to do it. I really do. But right now it's not in the cards.
And Ben closes out his query by saying he's been a fan of George since MGM VHS and Looney Tunes Laserdisc days. He hopes you'll be sticking around, as do the Archives label itself, one way or the other. Take care and be safe.
I think we're all of like mind in that regard, and thank you for the kind word.
Dear Matt, Dan, and George, thank you for your Blu-ray releases of the past several months of many of the studio-era classics many of us longed for years. They've included spectacular presentations in both color and black and white, and he's a long list of titles, but he knows you can't answer everything, but he appreciates any hints of what might be in the pipeline. So he asked, any other Samuel Goldwyn classics possibilities?
The Samuel Goldwyn Jr. Family Trust is the owner of that library, of which we are the distributor for home entertainment, physical as well as transactional digital. The Samuel Goldwyn film elements are not in the best of shape, and that library needs a lot of help. So there are some films where you'll see a master, let's say in streaming, from another company that has the streaming rights, and it's in HD, but you can see how battered the film elements are. And to complicate it, the original negatives to most of those films were either lost or destroyed. I think the exception, there may be one or two exceptions, and I know the exception also carries over to the Technicolor films, but that's a library that needs a lot of work and a lot of help. So the Film Foundation, I'll say that again, the Film Foundation came to the rescue, working with the Academy and helping us provide you with a gorgeous restoration of Dodsworth, and we hope there will be more Goldwyn restorations to come. But that would have to be a decision made by the Family Trust, as well as others involved in the distribution of their films.
And Terry closes by saying, I've been with you since the beginning of Warner Archive, and in the case of George, since he is restoring, releasing soundtracks. Listen to every single podcast and regularly pre-order Blu-ray releases as soon as they announce available. Thank you all you've done to restore and preserve classic film and to make them available in state-of-the-art presentations. Sincerely, Terry in Ohio.
Thank you, Terry. We all appreciate it.
And this is from David. Hello there. I just have general questions concerning a few movies and potential restorations. Are there any updates concerning The Wind and The Crowd? I love that question. Do you have any Norma Shearer or Greta Garbo movies planned? I'm a huge fan of both, and I'm surprised that the reigning queen of MGM and her biggest competitor are barely represented on Blu-ray. As for big titles from either, I'm especially hoping for Marie Antoinette and Queen Christina. Do you have any plans for Ernst Lubitsch's The Merry Widow? Thank you ahead of time, David.
There is a plan for the crowd and the wind, but in terms of the Garbo and the Shearer films, none of them are scheduled. I would love to see them released. We did do new masters of a lot of them for DVD, especially things like The Merry Widow, which we put a lot of work into. But at the time, we didn't think that we would be in the Blu-ray business. We have to go back and do them all over again and spend a lot more money. But I do think that we will see those films, and we'll see them probably sooner than later, probably in 2022, 2023.
Dear Mr. Felsen, thank you so much for answering my letter about Paradise. You have no idea how happy you've made me and the people in the Paradise Facebook group. I'm not sure where I've become obsessed with making this happen, and Phil, it's already a work in progress. We were talking, always an way to start a sentence, about whether or not there was a possibility of getting bloopers or deleted scenes or even, dare I say, a commentary or two. When I saw how little time is left when you started to read my longest letter, I was sure I'd get it, never heard of it, but no, I was thrilled with the response. In that spirit, I figured it couldn't hurt to ask if anything special could be added, as long as you're putting the shine on it. Thank you again, Lillian.
Well, I can say that right now, the work we have to do is all of the negative has been scanned. The reels need to be edited. They need to be color corrected. We've got to deal with making sure we have all the sound. Right now, the focus is on getting this series out. And right now, I couldn't even say whether it would be DVD or it's probably unlikely for Blu-ray, although given that it's had 4K scans, you'd think we would do Blu-ray. But it's very, very, very expensive for compression and authoring to release a series on Blu-ray. It is very expensive. And we have to make a profit for our shareholders. So a DVD is the best hope. And a DVD of the episodes is what I'm thinking is most likely, and there would not be bloopers or extras or commentary.
I want to inform everyone that ever sent us a physical copy of a letter that we read on the podcast, and I would end up as the keeper of the letters. Very recently, I received a message from a colleague who works for the corporate archives, and your letters are going to be entered into the corporate archives, where they will be living forever alongside studio memos from Jack Warner, and future historians will puzzle over who we were and why you were writing to us. So congratulations, you've made history. But also, if you have been writing to us, I am going to inform you that as of now, don't bother with the emails because, like Matt, I am now being transitioned away. We don't know what the future brings, but the email address, podcast@wb.com, which yeah, we just got working again, and thankfully we did so we could read these letters to you. Don't bother. You're going to have to keep your ears to the ground, and hopefully you'll be able to find us again. But right now, we have no way, and don't use that email. And don't use the physical address either.
Yeah, it's going to go into a hole, a special hole with all the old nitrate print and lit on fire and put under the 134th way.
That happens only in Rochester.
But it's been great having this conversation. If you need to find me, look for me at Dwiff, D-W-I-F-F. On Twitter, which does not stand for Detroit Windsor International Film Festival, even though many people think it does. And I have to tell them, don't send me your film.
Dan, I didn't even know that happened to you before. And I am on Instagram and Twitter at MR Matt Patterson. It's one word.
And on that note, we want to thank you for all of your support. It's been 12 great years of the Warner Archive as we have our birthday celebration today. And we're all sitting with our respective birthday cakes because we have to be quarantined and doing this remotely. But we celebrate the 12th birthday of the Warner Archive with thanks to you, the consumer, who has supported all of our many efforts over the years with great gratitude and thanks for all of your support. And on that note, I'm George Feltenstein.
I'm Matt Patterson.
Thank you. You could have been a help. but you've been so much more.
Thank you all for listening to this extremely long but very exciting Warner Archive podcast.